Mikdash begins with the emotional plea and prayer of Yehuda to spare the life of Binyamin in front of who he believed to be the viceroy of Egypt, as we have perhaps one of the most emotional sections in the Torah, where Yosef HaTzadik reveals himself to his brothers and says, Ani Yosef, Ha'od Avi Chai, I am Yosef, is my father still alive? We have the emotional reunion between Yosef and the brothers. Parsha basically, from that point, has really one theme, and that is the family of Yaakov Avinu coming down to Egypt, where Yosef promises that he'll be able to support the entire family there. And we have Yaakov Avinu being told about Yosef being still alive, and the whole preparation and the list of the individuals coming down to Egypt, and Yaakov Avinu himself making the journey down. We have the dream in Beersheba, where Kadosh Baruch Hu tells him, don't worry, I'll be with you, even though, in a sense, he's really walking into Golos now, as the entire Jewish people are entering the first phase of the exile as a community. We have the meeting of Yaakov and Yosef, as well a very emotional meeting after so many years of separation. And the end of the parasha almost is like a political description of how Yosef makes sure that the brothers are settled in Eretz Goshen, and how he's involved in really moving around all the Egyptians. He takes all their property, he moves them from different cities, and the laws of the priests, how they are not to be taxed, how they have a special privileged status. And the parasha ends how the Jewish people settle in the land of Goshen and are fruitful and multiply in that land. I'd like to raise or speak about two issues within the parasha. One more specific issue and the other a little bit more general. The specific one is based on a very famous medrash, on the pasuk when Yosef harnessed his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. He appeared before him, fell on his neck, and he wept on his neck excessively. We know, very famous Rashi, medrash brings down, is that Yaakov Avinu did not weep on Yosef. The pasuk tells us that he fell on his neck in the singular, and he wept in the singular. It was Yosef HaTzadik who was crying while Yaakov Avinu was saying the Shema. And the obvious question is, well, if it was time for the Shema, so then Yosef should also have been saying the Shema. Both of them should have been saying the Shema. What does it mean that this moment Yaakov Avinu was saying the Shema and not really embracing his son? We're very familiar with the often quoted understanding of the Maharal, who notes that when Yaakov saw Yosef, his son, as king, his heart was filled with love and fear of God. He noticed how his means of dealing with the world are good and perfect, how he rewards those who fear him. And when he saw all of this, he said the Shema, which is the unity of the kingdom of heaven, as well as the love that we must have for it. It was appropriate for him to say the Shema when Yosef came to him after all the trouble they had had because of his son. Now that he saw him as a king, he loved God who had done this for him, so he accepted upon himself his kingship and his love and fear. And as others mentioned, he took this tremendous amount of love he had for his son and directed it up to God. Question number one, or issue number one, is to understand this medrash a little bit more in depth. What is the symbolism of saying the Shema particularly at this moment? What can we learn from this medrash for our own lives? What directive does it teach us? The second more general issue is the tremendous emphasis that's found in the Torah at the end of the parsha on the Jews living in Eretz Goshen. Over and over again it speaks about how they have the best of the land of Egypt, how they lived in Eretz Goshen, how Paro set this land out for them. Why is the Torah focusing so much on Eretz Goshen? What is the symbolism, what is the importance of Eretz Goshen for the fact that the Jews were specifically there in their time that they were in Egypt? As the Sefer Meir Makim points out in phrasing this question, what is so special about this place? Why was it so important that the brothers specifically dwell there? I'd like to try to take two approaches to this question of what Eretz Goshen means. One, a very pshat-oriented approach, very literal approach, simplistic approach, and the second, a much more Kabbalistic, a much more esoteric approach. And both approaches to try to understand what Musar Haskel what lesson it has for our own lives. A more Pshat-oriented approach would be found again in the Sefer Me'amakim, who notes how Derech HaPshat Malat Eretz Goshen Niv'ah Me'etzem Hayotam Makom Miruchak Miyishuv HaMitzrim. On a technical level, the beauty of Eretz Goshen was that it was found far away from the Egyptians. It was like a land which was part of Egypt, but really was its own vicinity, its own neighborhood. Kidei Shebnei Yisrael Yit'adu B'Makom Echad, so the Jews should be together in one place, V'lo Yu Netunim L'Hashpa'at Tarbut Mitzrayim, so they should not become influenced by the culture of the Egyptians. Particularly in the fact that the Egyptians, as the Torah tells us, Toivat Mitzrayim Kol Ra'etzon, thought that anyone who was a shepherd was really an abomination, since they viewed the sheep as their god. And therefore, it was even better that they were separate from the Egyptian culture, who really would have despised them as being shepherds. And says Me'amakim very simply, the Musar Haskel that we learn from this, is Sheko Od Anachdu Nimsa'im Begalut, as long as we're found in Galut, Mesubavim Bashbaot Zarot, surrounded by many foreign influences, Aleinu Latur Achar Makom Megurim Shebo Nuchal L'chiot Chayim Yehudim Torim. We should always seek and search out a place that we can live a pure type of Judaism, that we can live a life where we're not going to be as affected by the outside culture, which can have a tremendous detrimental effect on our lives. And in fact, says Me'amakim, if you think that this is just a nice idea, you're wrong. He says, in fact, the Rambam in Hilchos Deos paskins this halacha. And the Rambam notes that derech b'riyato shel adam, it's the nature of a person, liyot nimshach b'deotav v'b'masav achar reyav v'chaveirav. A person by their nature is very much influenced by their surrounding, by their friends, by the people around them. And that's why, says the Rambam, it's very important that a person should connect themselves with tzaddikim, with righteous people, and be in an environment of righteous people in order to learn from their ways. And we know this to be true of our own lives. No matter how much we try to insulate ourselves, the environment around us seeps in and has a tremendous effect on us. You can see this as an example on a young child, but the example carries through in all aspects of life. Where you can have a family that doesn't watch TV, that doesn't go see movies, and the child is in a school, and all their friends are seeing the movies, and all their friends are seeing the TV shows, and the kids know the plots of the movies or the TV shows even without having seen it themselves personally. Because the influence around them so permeates who we are and what we are. So on this level, Eretz Goshen is the land which represents the Jews being able to set themselves apart from the outside influences and try to be able to maintain their identity in a very wholesome type of way. But continues Me'amakim and says that this place, Eretz Goshen, has importance also historically for the Jewish people. And he quotes a very famous Medrash in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer that when Paro in Parshas Lech Lecha, when Paro took Sarah in order to marry her, so he wrote her out a shtar ktuba, he wrote her out a marriage contract, and in the marriage contract he promised her gold, silver, cattle, servants, all the good stuff in life, as well as he gave her Eretz Goshen, he gave her the land of Goshen, La'achuza, as an inheritance for her, as a place for her to live. What does this mean, that Paro gave her Eretz Goshen? So it's very symbolic. Explains by Amaki, Sheparu hivtiach l'sara v'ktubatad kol otan matanot. Paru gave Sarah all of these presents kedei lashpi aleha shetazov et yechusa v'titabek bo, in order that she should really give up her past life and cling to Paro, embrace Paro. And that is indeed what the word Goshen really means. Goshen comes from the word hagasha, to come close, vayigash. The whole point of Eretz Goshen, giving her specifically Eretz Goshen, was for her to be able to come close to him. Symbolically, Eretz Goshen was meant to be the place that would bring Paro closer, or Sari Menu closer to Paro. And this is the beauty. Sari Menu didn't listen to Paro, and she remained loyal and faithful to her husband, and therefore, Eretz Goshen takes on a different symbol. It now becomes a symbol of Hitrachakut min Hagoyim, the distance from the nation. Eretz Goshen is separate of Pityav Shel Paro. Eretz Goshen speaks about the enticement of Paro. Vishtavuto Latsud Roshto et Sarah, and how he tried to entrap Sarah. And nevertheless, Sarah refused to listen to this. So now Eretz Goshen becomes the symbol of how Sarah Imenu was able to maintain her identity and her values and refused to be caught up in the enticements of Paro. So the fact that the Jewish people lived in Eretz Goshen was very significant. What they were really doing was following in the footsteps of Sarah Imenu, of being able to maintain their identity without being enticed into the culture around them. If on this level Eretz Goshen represents a place where the Jews are able to maintain their identity, where the Jews are able to be involved in really a community, in an insular community, I think there's also another level to this whole story of Eretz Goshen and how Yosef HaTzadik provided for his family. It wasn't only that he set up a physical land for his family called Eretz Goshen. There was something else that Yosef did in order to be able to maintain, that the Jewish people could maintain their standards that they wanted to, and to be able to really insulate themselves, to be able to maintain their identity. And here we see, in Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and Emel Tziyakov, a very interesting insight into the end of this Torah reading. He says, why does the Torah even tell us about all of what would seem to be the political decisions that Yosef HaTzadik made? Explains the Emel Tziyakov that if we look at the end of the parasha carefully, all the things that Yosef does with the Egyptians are really to make his family more comfortable. And that's why, for example, the Emel Tziyakov says, Yosef moved all of the people in Egypt from their original hometown and cities to other cities. He shifted everyone around. Why did he do this? So he did this for a very simple reason. So that everyone should feel like they're strangers, that they're aliens, that they're moving from place to place, so that the brothers shouldn't feel so alienated, shouldn't feel like they're the only ones who've been uprooted. All of Egypt was uprooted. All of Egypt felt that they were moved from their original place. So everything that Yosef did was really a sensitivity for his own personal family. Where we really see this, and I think this is the second level of what Yosef has done, what Eretz Goshen is all about, was that he established, and the Torah emphasizes at great length, that there was one class of people, the Kohanim, the priests, who were not taxed. They were supported from Paro's personal funds, from the kingdom, and they didn't have to go through all the other things that the Egyptians had to go through. So why is this so significant? So says the Emel Tziyakov, that Yosef prophetically established a precedent that would later benefit Israel while it was in Egypt. By giving a privileged status to the clergy, Yosef established a precedent that made it possible for the tribe of Levi, the Jewish clerics, to be exempt from the servitude to which Egyptians later subjected the other tribes, so that there would be a strong nucleus of people who kept alive the teaching of the patriarchs. The brilliant insight of the Emel Tziyakov. The fact that there's now a precedent in Egypt, that there's one group of people that don't have to pay taxes and that are treated differently. So when the Jews were then taxed, as the Torah tells us beginning of Parashat Shmot, by Yasimu Olam Sarei Misim Laman Anato B'Sivlotam, that taxpayers were put on them in order to afflict them, so there was one group of people that were not taxed. And that group of people was the tribe of Levi. And we know this as the tribe of Levi was never enslaved. All 210 years the Jews were in Egypt. And that's why we know the tribe of Levi was a smaller tribe than everyone else. Because they weren't enslaved, they didn't have the bracha of shisha bekeras echad, of six at once, because they didn't need that really as a compensation for their hard labors. Because of this, because Shevet Levi wasn't taxed, Shevet Levi became the tribe that was the strong spiritual nucleus of the Jewish people. And we find throughout the Jews' sojourn in the desert, it was the tribe of Levi who always maintained the spiritual standard. For example, the sin of the golden calf, it was Levi who came to Moshe's side to quell the rebellion or the people who were involved in the Egel. By the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, further say that Levi was not involved in this endeavor as well. They were able to maintain their identity and the spiritual identity and the relationship with God. This was the second thing that Yosef did. Not only did he physically put them in the land of Goshen, and the Torah emphasizes this to show us that you have to create within your life a spiritual haven, a place where you're not going to be affected by that which is surrounding you, there has to be a second level as well of creating a nucleus that's always going to be attached to God, always going to be involved in spiritual endeavors, and hence the emphasis on the group called the priests in Egypt, and later would be the Levim, who were not involved in the taxes and in the normal ways of the people. And that's why it says the Amos Yaakov, when both of these things was established, Eretz Goshen and the place of the Levi, the last pasuk in the parasha says, thus Israel settled in the land in the region of Goshen, they acquired property in it, and they were fruitful and multiplied greatly. Well, originally we know that when Yaakov came down, so he says that we're not coming here really to live here, but we're really coming here like Gur Ba'aretz Banu. We're coming here just to sojourn here for a short while. But by the end of the parasha, they're settling in the land. How do we explain this transition that they just came down for a short while, and by the end of the parasha, they're here to settle? So says the Amos Yaakov very simply. Once those safety nets and those safeguards were established, so then it was, they were able to stay there more permanently. Which explains the pasuk that before they came down, the pasuk says that he sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to prepare ahead of him in Goshen, and they arrived in the region of Goshen. So it's a very strange wording in the pasuk, laharot lefanav, to prepare ahead of him. So Rashi, based on the Medrash, says laharot lefanav means to establish a base Medrash, to establish a place of Torah. But they were really coming here trying to build the safety nets they needed while in exile. And on this level, we can explain the Medrash of Yaakov saying Kriyat Shema, quoted by the Shemi Shmuel, where he first quotes the Ramban as explaining that Yaakov's journey to Egypt marked the beginning of a dark period in Jewish history, the Egyptian exile. The Ramban explains that when Yaakov came down to Egypt, he perceived that the exile was beginning for him and his descendants. He was frightened of this, and so offered sacrifice to the God of his father Yitzchak, so that the rule of strict justice, which Yitzchak represents, would not be stretched out before him. At the moment of entry to Egypt, as the exile was beginning, Yaakov took action to ameliorate the strict deen. This he achieved by saying the Shema. By accepting the unity of God and pledging his love to him, Yaakov was able to reach beyond the strict judgment and invoke the mercy of God for his descendant. It continues to say, Shemi Shmuel, the lesson of this is clear. We know that the beginning of any enterprise is crucial. Yaakov therefore wanted to ensure that the Egyptian exile commenced with declaration of faith in the unity of God and in Yaakov's love for him. This would characterize the whole exile. That when Yaakov Avinu, as soon as he's walking into the land of Goshen, moment one, he meets Yosef, all he can think about is that beginnings are so important. And therefore he's investing in that first moment a tremendous amount of spiritual investment, of saying the Shema, of declaration of faith in the unity of God, of trying to bring about God's love, because this is what's going to help the people in terms of their stay in exile. And that's why it says the Shem Shmuel, Yosef doesn't say Shema, because Yosef's been in exile for a long time already. It's only Yaakov, who's now coming down for the first time into exile, he is the one who has to say the Shema, and not Yosef, who's already been there. We see here a pattern. They're coming into exile for the first time. They need to build as many safeguards as possible. Eretz Goshen, the tribe of Levi, the saying of the Shema, so that they're able to go through the exile experience and yet come out unscathed and whole in their beliefs and in maintaining their identity. I think on this level, which is level number one of the parasha, the Musar Haskel, the lesson for our lives, is quite clear. Each and every one of us is found in a Golus situation, an exile situation. And each and every one of us builds around ourselves different Eretz Goshen, different places where we protect ourselves. And even those people who aren't living in a ghetto life, often some community that never see the outside world, who still nevertheless, and again, each individual in their own lives, perhaps a little bit differently, builds our Eretz Goshen. We go to certain shuls on Shabbos, we send our kids to certain schools, we socialize with a certain group of friends. We ourselves know where to draw the line. What influences we'll allow into the house, what we'll allow over the internet, what we'll allow in the TV sets in our house, will we allow a TV set in our house? These are the different Eretz Goshens that each and every one of us has to establish in our life. The message on this level of the parsha is that when we live in a situation of galus, when we live in a situation of being so disconnected from God and our spiritual selves, we have to create around us a place of spirituality, a place of holiness, to surround ourselves by people, by classes, by teachers who are going to influence us, who are going to be the positive role models and the positive influences in our lives. But it goes beyond that. It's not only a question where we have to set ourselves up in Eretz Goshen. We have to be very careful about what surroundings we have, what surroundings our children have, what type of community we live in. We also have to establish for ourselves within our own lives a certain amount of levi as well. A certain amount of untaxed time where we devote solely and exclusively for God. The message of the parsha, where there's one group of people who are not taxed, one group of people who are able to devote themselves to study, that has to be a model for our lives. In order to survive, we need to dedicate a certain percentage of every day of our lives to the concept of Shevet Levi, which means that we should be able to be koveya, we should be able to establish every day X amount of time, whether it's going to be X amount of time learning, reading a sefer in Hebrew or in English. And it should be the same time every day, maybe 5 minutes before we go to sleep, or 5 minutes in the morning before the house really gets into a whirlwind, wherever it may be. Perhaps 5 minutes of doing a chesed every day. It doesn't have to be 5 minutes, X amount of time, where we'll devote ourselves to chesed every day or every week, where we are giving ourselves a sheva lazy aspect. You know, Baruch Hashem, in today's modern age, we all use, you know, like that kitchen clock in order to know when our baking is done. What a wonderful thing to use in terms of our own lives as well. We set the timer for 10 minutes. We turn off the phone, we put everything aside and say 10 minutes, 5 minutes, we're going to be learning. And while that timer is working, this is what we're involved in. And this is the ability to really establish and set for ourselves a routine in life of creating that untaxed aspect, creating that time that's reserved within us that's going to be dedicated between us and God. This is what's going to allow us to be successful. This is what's going to allow us, as what happened to the Jews, to be able to come out of Egypt, as difficult as it was, and to be able to form a relationship with God at Mount Sinai. That's level number one. The second level of the parsha is a little bit more esoteric. And it's based on Avnei Yisachar. Quoted in English by Rabbi Munk in the Call of Torah, where he says the word Goshna, and again the Pasuk where he sent Judah ahead of him to Yosef to prepare ahead of him in Goshen, and they arrived in the region of Goshen. So we know that the word Goshen on this Pasuk has the same numerical value as the word Mashiach. It explains that the Redeemer is called on to deliver Jewry from the yoke of the four nations which enslaved it, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, and the Romans. The Messiah, the son of David from the tribe of Yehuda, will be preceded by Mashiach ben Yosef, the Messiah descending from Yosef. On reaching Egypt on this level, Yaakov ardently hopes to see this messianic reunion of his two children, Yehuda and Yosef, one day come about. And he sends Yehuda to meet Yosef, so these two, who represent the ten lost tribes and the two who remain faithful, might together pave the way for the coming of the Messiah. And the second part of the verse refers then to Yosef. He shows the path of the Messiah before Judah. On this level, Goshna is really a vision of the future. That Yaakov sends Yehuda down to Goshen to meet Yosef is that the concept of Yehuda and the concept of Yosef, Mashiach ben David and Mashiach ben Yosef, are to meet together in Goshen because Goshen numerically represents the Mashiach. Let's try to understand this a little bit more deeply. What's the significance of specifically in Egypt, and why does Goshen represent the concept of Mashiach, the concept of the Redeemer? So Bnei Yisachar explained that Egypt really represented the paradigm of all future Golios, of all future all future exiles that were to occur in the Jewish people. It's hinted out in the verse, in the beginning of Parashat Shemot, Vahi bayamim harabim, it was in those many days that the Rashi Tevot, the acronym of Rabim, is Romi, Rome, Bavel, Babylon, Yavan, Greece, and Madai, the Persia and Media. And that's why there's such an emphasis, explains the Bnei Yisachar, on redemption from Egypt. Because it's almost as if we're able to get out of Egypt, and we can focus in on the Egyptian redemption. All the other exiles will also follow in that pattern of also finding a redemption, getting ourselves out of these difficult straits. So the fact that Yehuda is sent to Yosef in Goshen, which is in Egypt, is really a representation of that, just like we were redeemed in Egypt, the redemption, the ultimate redemption, will likewise happen as well. How do we understand, though, however, that Goshen represents Mashiach? So again, very beautiful concept of Bnei Yisachar, which we'll try to understand and explain, although a bit esoteric, is that the word Goshen, Goshna, is really a Rashi Tevot, is really an acronym for four forces that comprise the totality of human aptitude. The Gimel is for Guf, the body. The Shin is for Sechel, the intellect. The Nun is for Nefesh, which is the emotional realm. And the He is for Hakol, which embodies all of these. And he explains that the letters are the initials of four words designating certain forces in man. And it was the corruption of these forces which brought about the sufferings of the exile in the above-mentioned four nations with the intention of removing this corruption. Each of the exiles represents a time when the Jews had a weakness in one of these four areas, and each one of these four empires really dominated one aspect and characterized one aspect of each of these four concepts. And he explains that we have Bavel really dominating the aspect of the Nefesh, of the emotional realm, and that's through the destruction of the temple, because the korbanos, the whole service in the temple, was really our connection emotionally to God. We have the next exile of Madai, the Purim story, that was really trying to destroy us physically. That's the guf, as the Megillah says, la shmid, la rog, la beid, to try to physically annihilate us. Yavan, as we know, is clearly against the Seichel, against the intellect, the whole Greek wisdom that they try to bring into the Jewish thought. And Rome represents Hakol, because Rome was really involved, and is still involved, we're still in Golos Edom today, the Christian world that we live in really trying to overtake us on all these levels. They destroyed the temple, which was the nefesh, the emotional aspect. They tried the Crusades, the Holocaust, like Jewish history, to destroy us physically, as well as we've seen throughout the generations to destroy us as well on a intellectual level as well. Goshna therefore represents the four nations that try to dominate the Jews, the four nations that try to really take us away from our relationship with God. And therefore, it's the downfall of all of these nations that will have the ability to bring about the Mashiach, to bring about the ultimate aspect of Goshna, of all of Jewish history, is on the path of Mashichut, on the path of Mashiach. And that's why, explains the Bnei Yisachar, the key in really being able to bring about the downfall of these four nations and what these nations represent is the ability for the Jews to really rally together, and not only to be together as a nation, but to believe in the oneness of God. And that's why significance of Yehuda, because the name Yehuda has in it the Yudke Vavke, the name of God, with the letter Dalet at it. The letter Dalet represents the four corners of the world, the four empires that try to rule over us. The way to counteract those empires is the Yudke Vavke, is to believe in God. The key really is to take all of these elements, the emotional, the physical, the spiritual, the intellectual, the totality of who we are, and instead of focusing it on ourselves and on unworthy causes, and that's why these empires came and were able to dominate us, we have to have all of them focused in around God. We have to take all of that spiritual energy and make God our focus. And that explains the famous custom that we have. We'll say a custom. It's a minhag Yisrael to play a dreidel on Hanukkah. Because we know in Golos, in exile, what are the letters on the dreidel? So it's these same letters. Neis Gadol Hayasham is Nun Gimel Shin Hei, which is Goshna. It's the same attributes that we're finding. And as the Bnei Yisachar says in 31, on the festival of Hanukkah, when the flame again begins to brighten the nights of our exile, and that's what really Hanukkah is. It's the foreshadowing of the redemption. The dreidel becomes a symbol of the four kingdoms which enslaved us because of our fourfold decline. But at the same time, it reminds us that all of human existence and all of human history rotate about the messianic axis, and that everything ultimately comes to Goshna, that is, to messianic redemption. What is the concept of the dreidel? It's brilliant. The concept of the dreidel is having the four sides rotating around one center. The only way that we're able to overcome the different nations is to be able to keep that dreidel spinning and not to have it fall on one side. And the way we're able to do that is to be able to focus and rotate on that center point of the Yichud Hashem, of the oneness of Hashem, of Ayah Bayom Ahu, will be on that day that Yehashem Achad Ushmo Achad, that He will be one and His name will be one. This is the key. The key is to be able to maintain that identity. So on this level, the concept of Goshna is a very symbolic concept. Goshna represents the four kingdoms that came to rule the Jews because of the four aspects wherein they did not focus it in on God. They used the seichel, they used the intellect, they used the emotions, they used the body for self rather than directing it toward God. And therefore, each of these kingdoms had to come as a punishment, so to speak, in each of these areas, as a corrective measure in each of these areas. When the Jews have the ability to focus their entire being around the axis, the middle part of the dreidel, the axis of Yichud Hashem, so then the Goshna, which was the negative aspect, the aspect of exile, turns into the Goshna of the Mashiach, the numerical value of Messiah, turns into the Goshna of the hope for the future. And that's why it's specifically Yehuda who's sent down to Goshen, because Yehuda represents the concept of God's oneness within all these four elements, and Yehuda represents the Mashiach, the king, or the dynasty of the Messianic king. It's on this level that we understand that Yaakov was saying Kriyat Shema means, says the Orga Dayahu, almost the exact opposite of the Shem Shmuel we saw earlier. The Shem Shmuel we saw that Yaakov now is beginning the exile and he wants to begin it on a good note. On this level, says the Orga Dayahu, that in the real sense, it's not that Yaakov Avinu is beginning a new exile, but to a certain degree, he's ending an old exile. The exile being distant from his son, and in real respect, being distant from God as a result. At the moment that he sees his son, at that moment he's able to have the clarity of vision and realize that everything he went through has a purpose. At that moment, he's able to say, Hashem Elokeinu, the Hashem of Rachamim, of kindness, and Elokeinu, the Hashem of Din, of justice, is really Hashem Echad, is really one. That everything has a purpose, everything has a meaning, and there's really a Yichud Hashem, there's one God running this world. That's the point that he wanted the Jews to bring about when they were going into exile. And that's why Yosef, who was already in exile, doesn't mention this, doesn't say the Shema. It's only Yaakov who says the Shema because Yaakov was trying to inculcate that idea into his children. You're going into Golos, you're going into Goshen, let me tell you the key of Goshen. Let me tell you how you're going to be successful in Goshen. You're going to be successful in Goshen by understanding the concept of Shema, of the Yichud Hashem, of the oneness of God, that Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, there is only one God. And no matter what happens in this world, understand that focus. Understand that the dreidel has to spin around the center axis. The question becomes, how do we relate this esoteric idea into our lives? What Musar Haskalah, what lesson do we learn from the fact that Goshen represents these different forces in life, these different exiles, and our ability to connect with God, the dreidel running around the axis of God? So I think perhaps one approach to understanding the relevance and the directive for our lives can be found in one of the most beautiful psukim, one of the most beautiful midrashim on this pasuk, which is found in our parsha. The pasuk says, "And Yosef fell on the neck of his brother Benjamin and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck." This is the reunion of Yosef ben Binyamin, the two brothers, who are real brothers from both their mother and their father. At this moment of the reunion between these two brothers, Rashi, the Medrash, says, what does it mean that they're falling on each other's necks and crying? So it just doesn't mean that there was a tearful reunion between these two brothers. Talmud interprets their weeping on each other's necks as expression of pain and sorrow over future tragedies in the respective histories. Yosef wept over the two sanctuaries that were to stand in the territory of Benjamin and were destined to be destroyed. And Benjamin wept over the Shiloh sanctuary that was to be stand in the territory of Yosef and was destined to be destroyed. So on a simple level, this medrash is a little bit difficult to understand. We understand that all medrash is really a clue and something much deeper, a key to understanding really worlds of wisdom. So perhaps a simplistic understanding of this medrash, Ma'aril Diskin points out, is until now, both Binyamin as well as Yosef were really in a state of avelus, of mourning. They couldn't really achieve real simcha. This moment of real simcha, of real joy, so now the divine presence which left them until now returned. And one of the first things that they saw in the Ruach HaKodesh was they saw how the two temples would be destroyed. So again, the question needs to be asked, well, why was this, that which they saw at this moment of such a happy reunion between them, they're crying over the sanctuaries, what does this mean? So Ksafelfer explains very beautifully, is that at this moment when the brothers are reunited, Yosef and Binyamin realize that the reason why they were separated for so many years was because of the lack of achva and achdus, the lack of brotherhood and friendship between the brothers, because of the kinna of the jealousy. And they realize that this problem which existed among the Shvatim, existed among the tribes, would only but continue as Jewish history continued as well. As we know, the second temple was destroyed because of sinas chinam, because of lack of love, baseless hatred. The first temple, the Talmud, one of the reasons says, is because they didn't give each other tochacha, rebuke, which really stems from not really caring about the other person. That's why you don't want to help them, make them a better person. It was at this moment, when they're now coming back together, that Yosef and Binyamin realize, says the Ksav Sofer, that this is just but a harbinger of what's going to come. That there's going to be more destructions of the temple, more places to cry because of this original rift that existed among the Jewish people. And that's why the temple was built in Binyamin's territory, because Binyamin was not involved in the sale. He didn't exhibit this lack of brotherly love. And the Mishkan was in Yosef and Shiloh's place because, as we saw last week, he really felt this brotherly love toward his brothers. So both of them had the sanctuaries, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and the temple in their portion because they expressed brotherly love, but because the Jewish people could not maintain this level, so therefore they're crying now, realizing the result of that which happened with the brothers. Let's try to understand it perhaps on a deeper level. And this is based on the writings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the book that we've quoted many times before, The Inside Story, edited by Rabbi Tauber, who says, what's the significance of weeping specifically on the necks and the significance of weeping? So he explains that the concept of necks in the Torah is a common metaphor for the temple. As the verse says, Hashem hovers about him all day and dwells between his shoulders, referring to the temple. And the often quoted verse, very famous verse about the temple in Shir HaShirim, It sings the praises of the Maiden of Israel and her relationship with the Almighty and proclaims, "Your neck is as the Tower of David." The sanctuary then is the neck of the world, the juncture that connects its body to its head. A person's head contains his highest and most vital faculties, the mind and the sensing organs, as well as the inlets for food, water, and oxygen. But it's the neck that joins the head to the body and channels the flow of consciousness and vitality from one to the other. The head heads the body via the neck. By the same token, the temple is what connects the world to a supernal vitalizer and source. It is the channel through which God relates to his creation and imbues it with spiritual perception and material sustenance. And as the soul fills the body, so God fills the world. Just as there's a neck that joins the world to its divine soul, so too there's a need for a personal temple in the life of each and every individual, and the neck to join his spiritual head to his material body. The human soul is pure, it's a perfect spark of its creator, the source of all that is good and godly in man. But in order that his head is life, man must construct a neck to join his soul to his material self. He must sanctify his mind, heart, and behavior so they may form a conduit through which his godly essence may control, vitalize, and permeate his entire being. And the sanctuary's destruction, whether on the cosmic or the individual level, is the breakdown of the juncture between the head and the body. That's why they're weeping on each other's neck, because the head is never a cause for distress, for the head can never be compromised or corrupted. It's the neck which is the break between the spirit and matter would be damaged, alienating earth from heaven and body from soul. Life is about making sure we have a good neck. Life is about making sure we have the connection between body and soul, between heaven and earth. Life is about the top of the dreidel, the neck of the dreidel, to connect the body of the dreidel to the Yichud Hashem, to ultimately to God, to be able to spin that axis, to be able to focus in on that center part, the connection between what's below and what's above. Each and every one of us has to work on that neck, has to work on that creation, on the small aspects of life, asking ourselves, is our religious life and our day-to-day life the same, or we really relegate one aspect to one part and another to another? I'm religious when I daven, I'm religious when I'm involved in religious activities, on Shabbos, whatever it is, but otherwise my life is my life, this is who I am. Or is there really an integration as the body is integrated with the head via the neck, a connection between the two, a flow between the two? And this explains the concept of weeping. It's interesting, this essay explains, is that Yosef doesn't weep over the sanctuary being destroyed in his territory, and Binyamin doesn't weep over the sanctuaries being destroyed in his territory. They weep over each other's territory. And Yaakov, who has all of the sanctuaries within him, doesn't weep really at all, and he says Kriyat Shema. What does this mean? So he asks a very obvious question. He says, what do tears actually achieve? So he explains that tears give vent to the feelings of distress and frustrations that accompany the knowledge that something is not as it should be. After a good cry, a person is somewhat relieved of these feelings, although the situation that prompted his tears remains unchanged. Is this a positive phenomenon? At first glance, it would seem not. Distress and frustration are what drive a person to rectify the negative reality that gave rise to them, to lessen them by other means which seem to counteract their purpose and utility. But what if one has done all there is to be done? In such a case, where weeping cannot be faulted for reducing the impetus for action, one can point to its constructive uses. It may serve to communicate one's empathy with a fellow's troubles, and it may serve to alert others to the gravity of the situation, others who are in a position to do something about it. In a nutshell, tears, if they're going to lead a person just to wallow in self and feel like they're not going to accomplish anything and just cry, and that's going to be their only way of fixing things, so then tears are very negative. But if tears are going to be able to help someone else out and to relieve the tension of self and to show empathy to others, so then tears are very helpful and they're very powerful. It's a very powerful and beautiful story. The Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis notes in her latest book She tells the story how she met a couple in the grocery market in the store, and she knew that the couple had lost their only child in a very terrible car accident. And when she met them, a couple of weeks after this tragedy happened, the man, the father, went over to Rebbe Simeon Weiss and said, "I must thank your husband. He really helped us through this difficult time when he came to pay us a shiva visit." So when she came home that night, she made mention that she met this couple to her husband, and she asked him, "Well, what did you say? What can you possibly say to a couple that loses their only child in such a horrible, horrible way at such a young age?" So her husband looked at her and said, "I didn't say anything." And he left it at that. And she said to herself, "He didn't say anything? He must have said something, because this was the consolation that they really felt in going through this terrible time." So a couple of weeks later, this couple came to visit her husband right after Shabbos, and her husband was still in shul. So she took this opportunity to ask them. She says, "I don't want to pry or anything." But she was curious. She herself was involved in a lot of counseling. She wanted to know what was her husband's secret. So she said to the father, she said, "Well, tell me, what did my husband say to you that really made a difference?" And he thought for a moment and he said, "You know, your husband didn't say anything to us. What happened was he walked into the shiva house, he put his arm around me, and he began to cry with me. And he just sat there and cried for a long time. And that for us was the greatest comfort, that somebody really felt our pain and was trying to alleviate through their tears our own pain. This is the power of tears. This is the power of empathy through tears." But ultimately, it's we ourselves who are going to have to pick ourselves up and change things. It's a beautiful medrash on the pasuk, "Shake yourself from the dust, O Jerusalem." The Medrash explains as a rooster who shakes off the dust from his wings. Our sages explain it's a wonderful imagery that when a rooster has wallowed in the dust, 1,000 people with 1,000 combs cannot clean it. But with a single vigorous shake, the rooster can free himself of every last speck of dust. One can educate, inspire, drive, and otherwise assist another to develop and improve himself. Ultimately, however, the only one who can affect any real and lasting change is the person themselves. Thus, Joseph and Benjamin allowed themselves to weep over the destruction of each other's sanctuary. But ultimately, only Yosef can repair the destroyed sanctuary at Shiloh, the Yosef dimension of Israel's relationship with the Almighty. Benjamin can only encourage and assist. After contributing all he could to Yosef's effort, Benjamin wept his agony and concern on his brother's neck. And likewise, the same applies to Joseph weeping over the sanctuaries in Benjamin's domain. However, concerning one's own spiritual ills, there is no such thing as having done all there is to do. God has granted free choice to man and has provided him with the resources and ability to overcome his every moral and spiritual challenge. Hence, the tearless approach of Jacob, Joseph, and Benjamin to the destruction of the old sanctuaries. To weep over one's own neck, over the negative state of the relationship between one's body and soul, is counterproductive, as it relieves and diminishes the internal forces that compel one to repair the relationship. Life is about working on that access, working on creating that neck, and not to sit back and say, "Well, it's such a damaged relationship, what do you want from me? I'll sit, I'll cry, be apathetic." The answer is that we need to weep and cry and to show empathy to others. But dealing with ourselves, we need to show the fortitude of saying, "I need to figure out how to rebuild that relationship. I need to figure out what I can do to take the different levels of the guf of the body, of the sechel, of the intellect, of the nun, of the nefesh, of the emotional, the hay, the entirety of who I am, and see how I can channel that to God. In my everyday life, when I'm faced with different challenges, on all aspects of who I am on self, to see how I can think of how I can look at the situation within a religious context. How can I look at the situation within a spiritual view?" This is the ability to constantly keep that dreidel going, to really focus around the one axis of the Yichud Hashem, the oneness of God. And that's why, in conclusion, instead of weeping over the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the resultant exile, Jacob recited the Shema, the Jews' proclamation of the unity of God and the imperative to translate his comprehension and awareness of God's unity into thoughts in his mind, feelings in his heart, words in his mouth, and concrete actions in his physical life. Instead of giving vent to his pain, Yaakov directed his inner turmoil toward the endeavor of rebuilding the damaged necks of Israel. Yaakov is the paradigm for us, that you have to say the Shema. You have to find a way to direct all that we have to the Yichud Hashem, to the oneness of God, to the endeavor of rebuilding the damaged necks of Israel. And that's why, in conclusion, we'll try to show in Parshat Vayigash is that Eretz Goshen takes on two very important aspects. One is the physical place where the Jewish people can live to create their own environment that's going to ensure that they have the proper influences around them in the service of God, and to create the Shevet Levi, which is going to be dedicated really for the service of God. And this is something that we have to work on in life. That Eretz Goshen of coming close is really the irony. It's the ability that we can turn away from that temptation of Paro and maintain our own identity. On the second level, Eretz Goshen is, on a more Kabbalistic level, representation of the forces in man, the forces in the world, the domination of the different empires trying to rule the Jewish people, and ultimately Goshen becomes the Mashiach. The ability to recognize that if we're able to spin the dreidel on one axis, on the belief in God, and the belief in ultimately the Mashiach, the time of Yichud Hashem, the oneness of God, then we're able to survive. And on this level, our job has to be to focus in on the neck, to focus in on the top of the dreidel, to be able to focus in on asking ourselves, how can we always build and repair and allow that relationship with God to grow? When we're confronted with different challenges in life, on all the different aspects of what Goshen represents, are we able to look at it through a spiritual vision? Are we able to elevate the situation into a spiritual one? And to try to understand more spiritual clarity within our lives, and not just segregate our physical lives and our spiritual lives as being separate, as being different. Goshen on this level is really the sense of coming close. That Goshen of Vayigash, of coming close, is the aspect of where we need to join together as a people and really come close to God. The Goshna, the Vayigas, is the ability of the Jews to form together as an Am Echad, as a one nation, in the belief of the one God. And this is the message of the Shema that Yaakov Avinu is involved in. On the one hand, it's the beginning of coming down to exile to really inculcate within the people the concept of God has to be with you first and foremost. It's also the message that Yaakov Avinu himself learned after his personal exile, that Hashem Echad, God is one. Understand this message of the axis rotating around one God. The Rachamim, the mercy, and the Deen are really one God. And in life, instead of sitting around and crying, it has to be a life of trying to build, a life of trying to take that which we have and elevate our relationship with God. And we know that the name of the parsha is really the significance of the parsha, Vayigash. We have to take the step forward. We have to come close. We have to take the initiative. We can't cry over our own necks. We cry over others' necks. We try to be empathic and help others with their difficulties in relating to God. But we're always Vayigash. We're always moving forward, creating our own little Eretz Goshen, creating our tribe of Levi, and try to understand how all of the four aspects of man can rotate around the one axis of the dreidel on the Yichud Hashem, the oneness of God, of making God primary in our lives.